the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and this morning Katie Mullally and I speak first with Kyle Dawson. He's a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Utah. He'll talk about the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument that is probing the fundamental physics that describe the universe. It's all about their search for dark energy. And then we speak with astrophysicist Dr. Mario Livio and Nobel Prize winner and professor of chemistry, Dr. Jack Szostak, about whether or not Earth is the exception to the rule for life. It's all in their new book, Is Earth Exceptional? The Quest for Cosmic Life. All that coming up this hour on Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Although the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument sounds like something used at Hogwarts to practice wizardry, it is very much something based in real science. However, the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument is working its own magic to probe the fundamental physics that describe the universe and measure the effect of dark energy. Here to tell us more about this earthbound and very complex instrument is Kyle Dawson, University of Utah Professor of Physics and Astronomy and part of the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument, or DESI going forward. Kyle, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Great. Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So give our listeners and Lynn and I an overview of the, I'm going to say it one more time, Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument.
Okay, so the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument, also known as DESI, that's how we call it, as its simple acronym, is an instrument we built over the course of about 10 years, actually. We conceived the idea in 2009, and we finished construction after everything, funding, whatnot, around 2020, just as COVID was happening. So COVID slowed things down a little bit, but we got up and running and started taking data in early 2021. And the goal of those data, what this instrument was designed to do, was to take measurements of as many galaxies as possible to effectively determine their distance and use that information to make a three-dimensional map of the cosmos.
One of the things I found really fascinating, among so many things about reading about this telescope or this project, is that this is a new use for the Nicholas U. Mayhall telescope. So back in 2018, you repurposed an existing telescope. Had this been done before to actually completely revamp an old telescope? And what a cool use of something already built.
Yeah. Okay. So this telescope was really cutting edge in 1970 when it was first constructed. And it had a great lifetime available to the whole astronomy community. People would propose for time, they do their own science. It sponsored a large amount of science over the decades. We repurposed it to be a dedicated facility specifically for one long-term survey. That's kind of unique in the fact that it was dedicated with one instrument, with one key observing program. That said, there are many telescopes around. They're always being updated and changed. The instrument configuration is always being improved. So that part in itself is not that unique. The part that's more unique is that we had this facility for so long and then changed it to be dedicated to one major program.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Kyle Dawson. He's a University of Utah professor of physics and astronomy, and we are talking to him about DESI, or the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument team. Kyle, tell us more about who makes up this team.
Yeah, so this is a really large collaboration. There is about 1,000 people distributed around the world, many different institutions from different countries, some universities, some labs, and our team does basically two different things. A large part of the team is really important for making the actual survey continue successfully. So taking the data, designing the software to make the telescope work correctly, actually constructing the instrument in the first place, maintaining it, et cetera. And then another large part of the team is responsible for taking those data and analyzing it and extracting the science. And of course, there's overlap between these two. Some people go back and forth. That's super important. But overall, the whole team works, you know, for years on the success of this project, both making it happen in terms of taking the data and then making it happen in terms of the analysis.
Okay. So I think for a lot of us, you know, what we picture is a map, a 3D map of, you know, all the galaxies as probably some graphic artist's rendition of what they imagine it to look like. And so if you're looking at what DESI is creating in terms of a 3D map, what does it look like, you know, for those of us who are lay people who are just used to looking at, you know, artist's rendition?
Yeah, okay. So we derived the three-dimensional map from the data from DESI. I'll get to what that data looks like in a second. But the actual map itself is, after all the processing, interpretation of the data, et cetera, and it's literally like a three-dimensional cloud of dots with structure in it. And if you actually look at how it appears, it looks like you're mapping out a sponge. And the dots that map out the sponge are the three-dimensional locations of galaxies and quasars. And that sponge is the structure that is formed because of gravitational collapse over 14 billion of years. So that's a preferred structure that is really important following the initial, you know, seeds of the universe. Those seeds form the galaxies that we see today, and the galaxies clump together in a pattern that makes it look like a sponge structure. Now, the DESI data itself coming out of the instrument do not give us this. What instead the instrument is designed to do is to extract all the light from an individual galaxy, disperse it like you would run light through a prism into its rainbow of colors, and record the full rainbow of colors ranging from basically a little bit blueward of what we can see with our naked eye to a little bit redward of what we can see with our naked eye. More specifically, it goes from about 360 nanometers to about 980 nanometers in wavelength. And it records those on a digital CCD. And that is the information we then model and extract to get this three-dimensional map. Now, what makes DESI very efficient is it's not doing it one galaxy at a time, but there's actually 5,000 little mini robots sitting in the focal plane of the telescope, and that's what we built for this instrument. And those 5,000 robots each hold a fiber optic that's basically the thickness of your human hair. And it moves that human hair or that fiber optic around until it's aligned with the light from a galaxy. And you have 5,000 robots each given a galaxy, so you have 5,000 galaxies, and you collect that light from those 5,000 galaxies simultaneously.
And we thought the 18 mirrors on the James Webb was pretty cool, but you've got 5,000 sensor points on DESI. What exactly, so in reading about the telescope and in the intro, we talked about how you guys are looking for dark energy. What exactly is dark energy and why is it important to find?
Yes. So what is dark energy? So back in like 1999, we learned that dark energy dominates most of the current universe in terms of its energy. So if I count up all the matter that we're familiar with, like protons and electrons and all that good stuff, neutrons, that only makes up a few percent of the energy in the universe. Dark matter makes up about 25%. And the rest is this thing called dark energy. So it's most of the universe. It's mostly responsible for the way the universe is evolving today, but we don't know what it is. We don't know why it's there. We know how much of it there is locally, but we don't know how it evolves with time or where it should be explained in our model of all of physics. So it's a huge mystery.
we talk with people from James Webb and the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope and even some Hubble. And here you guys are finding a whole completely different set of data points, it sounds like. I mean, aside from the 5,000 sensors versus the 18 on James Webb, what really differentiates you from these other non-Earth-based telescopes?
Okay, so that's a really great question. And there's really unique capabilities both from, say, James Webb and from DESI, and they're completely different. So James Webb really takes advantage of the fact that it's in space, and it's a huge mirror with really good infrared detectors. So it gets exquisite information, but on a pretty small area, or even maybe one or two galaxies at a time if it's actually taking the spectroscopy. But that's exquisite, really, really high quality data that I cannot get from the ground. Okay. DESI, on the other hand, is more about quantity than quality. So what we do, instead of looking at one galaxy at a time in great precision, we look at 5,000 at a time, just long enough to get a basic understanding of effectively their distance. And we then move to the next field, the next field, the next field. So we're about surveying the entire sky. We can survey about roughly about a third of the whole sky that's visible in the universe in terms of area. And James Webb would not be capable of covering that large an area, nor can Hubble. So that's one of the unique differences.
Well, I was reading on the press releases that in 2023, DESI data rules held nearly 2 million objects. How much of a fraction of the sky is that? Because to us here on Earth, 2 million, that's a lot. But I'm thinking that's a tiny fraction.
Yes. So when DESI's all said and done in our currently planned program, we'll get redshifts or distances to about 40 million galaxies and quasars. And that definitely sounds like a lot. So before DESI came along, the entire world had about 4 million redshifts. So we're going to increase the numbers by a factor of 10 in just a few years. However, in the whole universe, there's hundreds of billions of galaxies. So one of the tricks we have to do is be very selective about which of the galaxies we choose to get a spectrum of and to observe. And that's actually a pretty careful planning. And it took us months, probably at least 6 months, to figure that out. What was the optimal way to choose the objects to observe?
Mm. Okay, Kyle. So you compared DESI to the James Webb Space Telescope. And I know the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope also will be in space versus on the land. But it was my understanding as we looked into it that it's kind of trying to map similar things than DESI is doing. So can you talk about the difference between the two of those?
Yes. So another big difference is whether or not you take pictures of the sky, like an image, like more what we're familiar with, where you can see all the spiral arms of galaxies and everything at once. Nancy Roman is mostly built to take those type of images, and they're exquisite because they're from space. You don't have all the turbulence and wiggling and distortion from the Earth's atmosphere. So you get really clear images from space, but they're pictures. You can get them in multiple filters, just like you can see colors from your digital camera, but you don't get the high resolution spectroscopy that we get from DESI. So DESI can then look at each of those galaxies, or 40 million of those galaxies, not each of them, but 40 million of them, and actually get a real spectrum of how the whole features of the light across that wavelength range that DESI is built for. So we get good spectroscopy, which Roman cannot get over 40 million objects. So again, complementary.
Yeah, complementary. Okay, this is good. What's the definition of spectroscopy? And boy, that is a hard word to say correctly.
Yeah, so spectroscopy is the key difference between Roman and DESI. And spectroscopy is the technique by which we run light that might be white in the way it appears to our naked eye, and then disperse it. So we get how much intensity there is at each wavelength. So the image we're all very familiar with, which is basically spectroscopy, is running a white light through a prism and see it disperse into a rainbow of colors. So that rainbow of colors tells us how much light there is at every wavelength, how much red light there is, how much blue light, how much green light, but in really detail. We have 4,000 or 8,000 colors that we would be measuring the flux of the light at. And that gives us much more information about the galaxy than you can get by just taking a picture.
Well, a few weeks ago, we did an interview about Henrietta Leavitt, who discovered the distance of stars. As you know, you're shaking your head, you know. To think about how far we've come with what DESI is discovering. I mean, you think about it, she was able to find or postulate the distances of stars. And here you guys are in April just announcing that you made the largest 3D map of the universe. Well, we all think the universe is pretty big. So how big really is a 3D map, the largest 3D map of the universe?
Yeah, so I think the simplest way to look at it is when we think in 3D, two dimensions we're all very familiar with. You can just look north, south, and east, west. So very, very familiar. The third dimension, one can consider as distance or as time, right? Because it takes light time to reach us. So time sometimes is the easiest way to consider this. And in that dimension, we can see back about 12 billion years in the past. So we basically measure these 40 million galaxies over a huge fraction of the sky from distances that are very close, just a few million light years away, to all the way where the light has taken 12 billion years to reach us.
So DESI really would fit into Hogwarts with its ability to time travel.
Yeah, we see back into the past in great detail. And that's how we understand this nature of dark energy, is we see how it changes with time.
Wow.
How the universe is changing with time.
In reading through some of the information on your site, there's a whole bunch of information about tracing the expanding universe with bubbles. What?
Yeah. What? Okay, so now that's getting into the actual little technique we use. So far, we make this three-dimensional map. We locate the locations of galaxies with our spectroscopy and other imaging data. But what we actually care about are finding a very, very, very particular pattern that was imprinted in the distribution of galaxies way back, only 300,000 years after the Big Bang. And that pattern is everywhere. It's frozen in time. It has a very fixed size, and it appears like bubbles. So it's many, many overlapping bubbles, all of which are about 500 million light years in radius. And they're all superimposed on each other. They're all blended. And because we know each bubble has a radius of 500 million light years, it gives us a surveying tool. Just like when I go out and measure the length of my property, I can set up something on the front of the property. I know exactly how tall it is. I then measure the angle from the other side of the property, and I can deduce the distance to it. That's exactly the game we play. These bubbles are like my surveying tool. I know exactly their size. So if I measure the angle that they subtend, I can measure the distance to each bubble. And individually, it's very, very, very low. You can't actually discern individual bubbles. But statistically, over the whole sky, when I have these millions of galaxies, I can make measurements at better than a percent precision, which is actually really hard to do. Even like measuring things in the city, it's hard to measure things to 1%. Imagine going out with a ruler, you get, it's two people will come up with slightly different measurements. So it's really, really hard to do. But over the course of the 5 years, we're going to be able to measure this distance to like 7 or 8 different epochs in cosmic time, all to better than 1% precision. And that's how we deduce how the universe is changing with time.
That's crazy. Wow. So what were in reading about DESI and what you're learning about dark energy, there were possibly some mistakes that DESI is able to sort of bring to the surface to help astronomers understand that maybe the universe's fate isn't as dismal as once thought. So can you explain that?
Okay. So yeah, we were very surprised by what the results of the last year have been. It's not just DESI, but it's also some other programs. And for about 25 years, ever since dark energy was discovered, the leading model for it, the theory for it, was that it had basically a fixed energy density. It had a very particular effect on the way the universe expanded. And more specifically, because it had a constant energy density, it made the universe basically expand in a way counter to the way that matter would make it. So it actually made the universe expand faster and faster and faster, accelerate in expansion. Whereas matter couples to gravity to make things want to collapse. So it would make the universe want to slow down its expansion. So dark energy does the opposite. And for 25 years, we believed, you know, especially the best model was that it had this very specific feature that would cause the universe to just turn into a state where it just all acceleration and structure stops forming, everything stops forming, and you get into what in the long term would prevent new galaxies from forming and structure from forming. That was what we call the cosmological constant description of dark energy. And that actually is a direct consequence of Einstein's theory of general relativity. So he has a term from, you know, from his original theory of gravity that allows for this to happen. And that was our leading contender. In the last year, we've seen the most contradictory evidence to that I've ever seen. And it's not yet convincing, but it's starting to be in conflict at a level that surprises me, let's just say. Mm. And what it would look like is if I extrapolate forward, rather than having this term just act like Einstein's term for the rest of eternity, if the alternative is true, this dark energy is going to start to behave more and more like matter as time goes on. So it's going to stop this accelerating phase and cause the universe to go back to what is a more well-behaved slowing down in its expansion. Mm. We don't know yet. It's not significant enough to say it's a new discovery.
Yeah. Okay, so this is really interesting. As an astrophysicist, then, how do you explain to people? I believe I've seen out there in the conspiracy theory world, you know, some debunking of Einstein's theory of relativity. And this would be not disproving his theory of relativity, but it would be sort of adding to it or expanding on it. Is that right? How do you explain when people come up to you with that kind of stuff?
Yeah. Okay. So this is also could be a really detailed explanation. I'm going to apologize. So in the simplest theory, if this is dark energy, Einstein's theory of gravity would still hold perfectly well. And basically what the explanation is instead of a cosmological constant causing it, there's some other field in our standard model for all of physics that we don't know about, but we just discovered it. And that other field still couples to Einstein's theory correctly, as one would predict. And it's just like another aspect of physics we didn't know about previously. So completely independent of general relativity. There are also non-crackpot models out there, let's say, not conspiracy theorists, but we do ask if Einstein's theory is correct as well. And we leave ourselves open to the possibility that maybe Einstein's theory of gravity doesn't work on scales of many, many hundreds of millions of light years, which is the scales that we're talking about. And that's not totally unreasonable. So we would call it modified gravity. We've never seen evidence that modified gravity exists. Einstein's theory has passed every test on these scales we've ever tried. But it's not unreasonable because Einstein's theory of gravity doesn't really work very well when we talk about really, really small scales like quantum mechanical systems. No one knows how to make two protons interact through gravity, for example.
Before we let you go, this telescope, DESI, is in southern Arizona, just outside of Tucson. So it's really getting a good grasp of the northern hemisphere sky. Are there plans to build a complementary or similar telescope in the southern hemisphere so you can get the other half of the universe, if you will?
Yeah, getting the other half would be really great. It would give us better statistics and better precision on our measurements. You know, that's information we don't have. We're in this conversation right now about what to do in the long term. DESI will have a competitor instrument in Chile, which will have southern access. It's not going to be quite as powerful as DESI and not quite as dedicated, but we are looking to build something even more powerful than DESI down the line, at least 10 times as powerful. And we're trying to figure out the best construction for that, the best funding model for that, and the best scientific program for that. In the best case scenario, it would start about 10 years from now. It's a long plan ahead of us to get to that stage.
Well, one final question. How many years do you have DESI slated to operate?
So at the moment, it's only funded for five, and it started in 2021. So it'll stop in 2026 in the summer. However, we're currently trying to plan for longer observations, and we're requesting funding from our federal agency to support those observations. So we're in that discussion right now with the agency.
Well, that's good news. Well, we will include the links to the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument website so all of our listeners can go in and read more about it and see some of these amazing images. Our guest today has been Kyle Dawson. He is a University of Utah professor of physics and astronomy and part of the Dark Energy He's part of the DESI team. Kyle, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
How likely is it really for life to emerge on another planet? Well, that's a difficult question to answer until we know how life began on our planet. There have been incredible scientific breakthroughs over the centuries, like the theory of evolution and the deciphering of the structure of DNA. And biologists, chemists, and astrophysicists have learned much about the characteristics of life. However, the questions regarding the origins of life and whether extraterrestrial life exists remain. Joining us to talk about these big questions is astrophysicist Dr. Mario Livio and Nobel Prize winner and professor of chemistry, Dr. Jack Szostak. They are authors of the new book, Is Earth Exceptional? The Quest for Cosmic Life. Mario and Jack, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Well, I guess this is something I've never really thought about. We just assume that life formed here. Life could probably form anywhere else. What makes Earth possibly exceptional? I know it's a big question, an overarching topic, but Jack, why don't you go ahead and start with that one?
Okay. So we don't know how easy or hard it is for life to get started. What we're trying to figure out from all the research we're doing is to, you know, get some handle on that. We only have one example, right? So it could have been an incredibly rare event that, you know, in the extreme could mean that life here on Earth is the only place in the universe where there's life. On the other hand, like you said, it could be that, you know, maybe it's not that hard. Maybe life is widespread and present on many of the exoplanets that have been discovered orbiting other stars in our galaxy. We don't know. That's what makes it exciting.
Well, Jack, you are a chemist, and Mario, you are an astrophysicist. And I think when most people think of the search for life, we think of using looking at biological markers and chemical markers. And so that would mean chemists and biologists. But what role does an astrophysicist play in this search for life?
So look, as Jack just said, we don't know yet whether, you know, Earth is exceptional or not, but probably actually the answer to whether life is exceptional will come from astronomical studies, which try to find life in other places. And if we will find, you know, life on some exoplanets, then clearly, you know, we may decide that life may be even inevitable once the conditions are such that they allow life to emerge. On the other hand, if by the time we searched for tens or hundreds of exoplanets for which the conditions we think are right to have life and we don't find any, then we have to rethink that entire question. The thing is that what Jack and I are doing is that if you find life elsewhere, then Jack is greatly encouraged in his efforts to try to create life, if you like, in his lab. Similarly, if Jack manages to create life in his lab, then this supports all the astronomical searches because, you know, nature, with having billions and billions of places to look for and having a lot of time, could perhaps do it also. And this is really what makes the connection between us so important.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Dr. Mario Livio. He's an astrophysicist, and Dr. Jack Szostak, who is a biochemist and a 2009 Nobel Prize winner for the physiology of medicine. Okay,
So you both are at the top of your game. Mario, we've spoken to you before on this show, and it makes me wonder, I would love to be a fly on the wall when the two of you disagree, you know, when when Jack's trying to create life in his lab and Mario's saying that is entirely not possible because look what happened on Venus or whatever. So Jack, could you just let us into one of those fun times that these two scientists disagree?
I don't know that we really disagree. We obviously are approaching the problem from opposite ends. Mm-hmm. So, you know, our work in the lab and many of my colleagues, what we're trying to do is see, is there like a step-by-step process or all the steps are fairly straightforward and likely to happen? In that case, you know, life could be everywhere. Equally, we're trying to see, are there steps that are really, really hard that might make life rare? And so, you know, Mario is just coming at this from a different perspective that we have many, many places in the galaxy and the universe where we think the conditions would have been good. And then the question there is, how can we tell if there's life on a planet that's, you know, so far away?
Yes. Well, I love that answer because what I've noticed in the decade or more that I've been hosting this show is that scientists are no longer in these silos, and it takes the cooperation and the interest across many disciplines in science to really forward the work that any of you have been doing individually. So, Jack, if you could maybe expand on that and talk about what the benefit is of working with an astrophysicist like Mario to find out, you know, that big question that is the title of your book, is Earth exceptional?
I think one of the things that's kind of amusing about questions like this is that people tend to have strong opinions one way or the other, right? There are a lot of people who are just convinced that life is everywhere out there, and other people who are equally convinced that life is so complicated, mm-hmm. it's only here. And I think what Mario and I share is the willingness to say, we don't know. We have to study the question. We have to do everything we can from different points of view to try to get some insight into this.
Well, I know that one of the things that makes Earth exceptional is our location. We're in this Goldilocks zone is what I've heard it called. Mario, can you expand upon really what it is that makes Earth so perfect and ideal for life, specifically around where we are in our solar system?
Yeah, you think the point is that we think that water, liquid water, is very important for life because it acts as a solvent that allows for all those chemical reactions to happen. So, you know, we're looking for places which for planets, in particular rocky planets, that can allow for liquid water to exist on their surface. And that happens only when the planet is neither too near, too close to the star, because there it's too hot for water to exist, neither too far, because that's, you know, then everything freezes. So this is what creates this, what we call this range of distances, which we call the habitable zone, which is that Goldilocks zone that you indicated, where we think that it is most likely for a planet like Earth to sustain liquid water on its surface. Now, what has happened in the past 30 years or so is that we now know of many Earth-sized planets that are in the habitable zone of their host stars. And those are, of course, the places which we think are most likely to perhaps, you know, have life in some form. Mind you, I mean, you know, we're normally not looking for very complex life. I mean, you know, no elephants, you know, things like that. But, you know, where life allows for simple life forms to emerge, really of the type of life that Jack is searching for in his lab.
That's a great segue to Jack. Jack, what is your definition of life?
Yeah, that's
a small question.
Right? Yeah, yeah. You know, people have a lot of different answers to that. And what I try to say is, you know, what we're trying to do is understand the pathway that led from chemistry to biology, you know, starting the whole pathway, starting with planet formation, the chemistry going on the young planet, gradually more complex molecules being generated and concentrated. Then the emergence of cell-like structures that can grow and divide and transmit inherited information. And then the process of Darwinian evolution will start and give rise to more and more complicated forms of life. So I'm interested in that whole pathway. And I don't really care where you put the dividing line between living and non-living. It becomes a little arbitrary the closer you look. That said, I think the key thing is the capacity for Darwinian evolution. That's what allows life to adapt and become more complex and more interesting. So that's what we're really focused on.
Right. Well, Darwinian evolution aside, which is, it's so beautiful to hear about, and we will hopefully hear a little bit more, but I'm curious about the first signs of life on this planet. And, you know, we talk about amino acids and sort of the building blocks and the first cells. What presented as the first life on Earth?
So the earliest forms of life on Earth are about 3.5 to 3.7 billion years old. There are these stromatolites, which are these basically layered fossils of kind of bacterial life. Those were the first one that appeared. And to add to your previous question, you know, we don't find that the definition of life is particularly important to us, but we do note that, you know, life, at least all life forms that we know about, are characterized by some characteristics. In particular, you know, they are able to transport various properties from one generation to the next. That's one. It's all cellular. Namely, you know, life on Earth, at least, is all based on cells. There is metabolism, namely the ability to harvest energy and materials from the surrounding and do something with it. And then there is catalysis, which is the ability to enhance and encourage chemical reactions. So all life forms that we are aware of have these characteristics, and we you know, look for that. And I should also clarify that when Jack says Darwinian evolution, it doesn't mean necessarily this business of one species transporting into another, yeah, or metamorphosing into another. He means this even at the molecular level, that you generate certain, let's say, enzymes that work better than other enzymes and things like that. So that is the meaning of Darwinian evolution all the way.
Yes, absolutely. Well, speaking of, as Jack says, the signs of life can be very simple at times. But Mario, as you're talking about these various elements of life and the evolution of life, can you talk about the evolution of what has been found on other planets, or, you know, on Venus or on Mars?
So far, we don't have any clear, convincing evidence for life either on Venus or on Mars. On Mars, there have been a few claims in the past. The Viking experiments thought that they found some metabolism on Mars. That turned out to be not true. There was a meteorite that arrived to Earth from Mars, where there was a claim that some fossils were found in it. That turned out to be not true. Nevertheless, there are signs that liquid water exists on Mars, not on the surface, but, you know, a few miles down. And since Mars formed basically from the same part of the solar system as the Earth, research continues to try to find evidence for past life on Mars. In Venus, well, Venus is not that conducive. I mean, on the surface of Venus, lead would melt. But there have been some claims that compound called phosphine, which is based on phosphorus and hydrogen, was found in the upper atmosphere of Venus. And on Earth, that one is done also by some sort of bacteria. The good thing about that is that there are planned missions to Venus that will investigate this further, and we will see whether this indeed exists and, you know, what are the chances that this was formed by some forms of life.
The search for signs of life has actually become a little bit more complicated recently because we now know that many of the molecules of life can be made just by chemistry. So, you know, if you find amino acids or even more complicated things, that by itself is not ironclad evidence for life. It could be chemistry left over from earlier times. So there's a lot of interesting discussion about how to actually be sure you've detected life.
Well, I remember years ago, the search for life was all, the verbiage around it was carbon-based. And is that still the parameters under which you look, or are there possibilities of life that are maybe silicon-based or another base that maybe we haven't searched for?
I think realistically, carbon-based life in water is what we should be looking for. You can always say there's some different way that it could happen, but there's not really any realistic idea about exactly how that could happen.
Let me just add to that, that there has been a serious study, for example, you mentioned silicon, whether it can replace carbon. And the final conclusion of that study was that at the end of the day, carbon is the chemistry for life. Silicon is the chemistry for rocks.
And we've found lots of rocks. We've got that one covered. Well, I guess, Jack, I'll start with you on this question. How is the evolution of AI? It seems like we're creating our own whole new life form here on Earth with the development of AI. How is that shaping your understanding of how organic life forms?
So there's been a lot of advances in computer modeling of chemical reactions and trying to understand in detail how reactions go. Where modeling the quantum chemistry is very, very difficult. So I think AI-based approaches are going to have a big effect on that. So far, I don't think there's been any great input from AI in thinking about how life got started, because what's limiting us are really conceptual advances. So, you know, if you can do all the best modeling you want, but if you're modeling the wrong thing, it doesn't get you anywhere. So I think we need ideas, which for the future, at least for a while, will come from people.
Let me just add something to this on a different level. If you are to believe some of the AI gurus, then it is possible, in principle at least, that at some point in the future, machines will become the dominant intelligent species. If that were to be true, then, you know, it is possible that biological life is actually only a relatively short phase in evolution of complex life, and that most of the life in the galaxy, let's say, is dominated by machines. That would mean that our search for intelligent or complex life should change based on that concept. At the moment, we really don't know whether any of this is true. In particular, we have no idea whether something like consciousness, for example, is an emergent property, namely that every complex system eventually develops that, or that's something that is really unique to the type of wet brains that we or dogs have, in which case machines will always just remain, you know, what some philosophers call zombies, and not the type of life that we are interested in.
Well, that just brings up a question for me, Mario and Jack, about how much these kinds of sort of existential questions are affecting the work that you do. I mean, when we're talking about things like consciousness, or, you know, if AI has consciousness, has it so far, you know, punctuated or interrupted kind of the work that you've been doing? Jack, I'll let you take that one to begin with.
You know, I think those things are really interesting to think about. They're really fun concepts, and things are moving quickly. So, you know, it is an exciting time. But no, in terms of what we're doing, no, like we have very specific things that we're trying to figure out, and so yeah, there hasn't really been much impact from that side of things.
And for you, Mario?
Well, the only way again that we are thinking about this is that If, for example, machines like this, do become sort of a dominant species, it means that the way we search for intelligent life, which is usually, to search for radio signals or things like that and so on, may not be the right way to go about that. Mm. And in particular, such machines don't even need to be tied to a surface of a rocky planet. These machines perhaps work best in space, just in space. So this has still not really influenced in any important way the searches for life, but it's definitely something to think about.
Yes, yes. Well, I always love to hear more on things like Fermi's paradox and the Drake equation. I know you talk about this in your book, Is Earth Exceptional? And I mean, these concepts were created by, very advanced scientists a long time ago, and yet they're kind of simple concepts. The Fermi's paradox, while there's no proof, it seems highly likely. I don't know if that's the layperson's definition of Fermi's paradox. But Jack, yeah, how have those kinds of things evolved over the time that you've been working?
So if you take the Drake equation, right, which was when it was formulated, was basically a list of all of the things we didn't know, and which made it impossible to think of how common or rare life was. But now we can put numbers on many of those variables. How many planets are out there, for example, how many are likely to have reasonable environments. So that's really changed and developed a lot. In terms of the Fermi paradox, I think we have more and more answers to that. And the more and more dangerous things start to look here on Earth, the more likely one of those answers seems to be that, it's not really clear, how long humanity can sustain its own existence, which is a very scary thing to think about.
Yeah, if I may add to that. So first of all, the Fermi paradox, on the astronomical side, there has been great advances in terms of finding the right planets and things like this. On the biological side, in terms of those things that appear in the Drake equation, it just highlights our ignorance so far in terms of what's happening there. The Fermi paradox, the fact that there are at this moment about 100 possible solutions, basically emphasizes the fact that there is not one compelling solution to the Fermi paradox, so we still really don't know what the answer is.
Before we let you go, a couple final questions. Jack, how close are you to producing a living cell in the laboratory?
Well, if we're lucky, it could be just a couple more years. But I've been saying that for a long time. So you never know when you're going to run into unexpected problems or questions.
It's not going to be like that thing on Cosmos years ago where Carl Sagan dumped all the elements of life into the fish tank and nothing crawled out.
Yeah, that's the kind of creationists use that kind of argument. But we know a lot about the steps that things have to go through. But there are many more steps that we're trying to study in the lab and figure out what is the way that it could have actually happened on the early Earth. And is there only one way or many, many different ways? Those are some of the questions we're getting at.
And Mario, one last question. How close are we to discovering extraterrestrial life?
Well, again, I would say that within 10 to 20 years, we will either discover some relatively convincing biosignatures, like atmospheres that are completely out of chemical equilibrium, things like that, which indicate life. Or I think we'll at least may be able to place some meaningful statistical constraints on how rare life actually is. Namely, maybe we'll be able to say, even when the conditions are right, the chances of life actually emerging are less than 1%, let's say, or things like that. So I honestly think that this can happen within the next 10 to 20 years, in particular, that there are telescopes in planning the Habitable World Telescope in particular, so that that will happen. But like Jack, I'm afraid that maybe, you know, after 10 years, I will tell you, oh, we need 10 more years. We will see.
Well, our guests today have been Dr. Mario Livio, astrophysicist, and Dr. Jack Szostak, a Nobel Prize winner and professor of chemistry. They are the co-authors of the new book, Is Earth Exceptional? The Quest for Cosmic Life. Mario and Jack, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
And thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW. If you'd like to find this episode on other platforms, you can go to our website, kpcw.org, under the Shows tab, or wherever you get your podcasts under KPCW Cool Science Radio. You can also find it on the NPR app or the KPCW app. Please rate our show and share it with our friends. And if you have an idea for a show, please email us at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.